Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Cambridge Inside Out. I'm Robert Winters, and with me today.
And I haven't showered. My name is Patrick Barrett. I'm a first time caller, long time listener.
Yeah, right. Whoops. I got so disturbed by that assertion that I smashed my computer and sent it nearly flying right there. So anyway,
from the Sullivan Chamber.
Yeah, actually, not only fresh from the Sullivan Chamber, but that's for me. But you're fresh from, was it Disney World?
I am Disney World. I mean, I'm wearing my Dollywood shirt today. But the whole family went to Animal Kingdom for like 5 days. It was awesome. Actually, it was really
the first day was enjoying it, and then the other four were trying to find the kids that were lost among the animals.
in search of a margarita in Animal Kingdom, and so it's a tough find.
I think that's a pretty good, worthwhile search, though.
Yes.
So let's just dive right in, shall we?
Do it.
All right. So today, this may be a little bit of esoterica for some, but I do find it quite interesting. So there was today a meeting that has been planned for some time of the City Council's Economic Development and University Relations Committee. Mm-hmm. On the topic of, well, at least what the report says, is development standards and costs, which sounds terribly unexciting, doesn't it?
Oh, but I found it to be just riveting. But, you know, they try to downplay the exciting stuff a little bit just to keep the crowds down.
Right. Now, my recollection, and again, Phil, correct me if I'm wrong on this, was that there was a city council order from, I believe it was Denise Simmons, some time ago.
She made that policy order, I think, in 1903.
Yeah, that's it. I remember that. Yeah, way back when. Yeah. And basically, I think it was in response to the fact that we were basically being hit by one ordinance, one initiative, one change in linkage. You're going to up the linkage fees. They're going to burden housing development projects with inclusionary zoning. There were also costs associated with various green initiatives, et cetera. And again, I'll just give you the intro here. You can put the meat on the bones, but nobody ever really talks about the cumulative impact of a whole raft of regulations and initiatives, right? So I thought it was a brilliant order to come up with to sort of suggest, well, come on, can we just take a step back and take a look at this? So now, I wasn't at the hearing today on this, but you were, but maybe you could say a thing.
I was at the hearing. I was a panelist today. Everyone had to listen to me talk about development for about 4 or 5 minutes, which was kind of exciting. But the policy order, which was really Denise Simmons had started it, Paul Toner jumped on top of it, Mark McGovern, and I believe Burhan Azim had also expressed some interest. And it was really to sort of take a look at the 7 or 8 ordinances or regulations and zoning that we have that, you know, they've never really been looked holistically. Like, how does this really all relate to development? And, you know, to the CDD's credit, they put on a great presentation, at least in terms of the substance of what they presented. There was a little bit, you know, of a critique at the beginning because they showed construction numbers from 2011 to 2015. And we all quickly said, you know, shenanigans, they were trying to be illustrative of like the ratios of cost. But, you know, when you show these to the general population and they look at a hard construction cost of $159 a foot,
I'm just switching to that pie chart right now.
They probably say, oh, what are you guys even talking about? But in reality, that with $159 a foot number is closer to 700 right now. So
it's that different.
Yeah.
I mean, now when they say total, see, I've always been a bit mystified by the talk about development costs and how much does it cost per, even when people talk about what's the going rents in Central Square for retail spaces or whatever, right. I'm always a bit mystified by it all. Right. But what it's asserting here, this was as of 2015, was that in order to, you know, on average now, if you, you know, just typical projects, total development costs per square foot of development, that's of the total occupiable space, is that what it refers to by square foot?
Yes.
Right. So they were saying
you're looking at a gross number. So like it's the gross square footage. So you're, you know, even though you can't hang out in mechanical space, I still have to build it. And there's still a number associated with it. So that this number represents in the aggregate, the total building construction cost.
So that GFA, gross floor area, is that what that refers to?
Correct.
Okay. So if it was 273 and change in 2015, 8 years later, what would you conservatively throw the number at that today?
Well, here's a fun fact. In 2011, 2015, the number was also not 273.59. This is aggregated across housing projects. So it doesn't really capture the gamut. I'd say back then, and I've looked at other projects that I've done during that time. I'd say the average cost is $300 a foot inclusive, maybe 325 in that range. Today, all in, depending on what you're doing, lab costs can range from $1,200 to $1,600 a foot. Residential upwards of around $600. Commercial mixed use hotel, for instance, around $900. So significantly more than what they're showing here. And even though they were trying to show the ratios of cost, how it sort of spreads,
yeah,
that's also changed a little bit too because of all these regulations that they have put in. Inclusionary zoning being sort of the biggest one right now on the residential side, the inclusionary zoning is the requirement to give the city a certain amount of housing. Now that they've changed it, I give them essentially 20% of the building, and they sort of chop it up into what they want. There's a real cost associated with building that and with giving it to the city that we would argue that the 30% density bonus that you get for that isn't an apples to apples comparison anymore. In fact, I've done it on paper, and it's more like, giving the city $35 and getting back four is about the spread.
When the amended version of inclusionary zoning was passed several years ago,
yeah,
I was quite surprised at the specifics of what passed, because I remember back in around 1998, 1999, or maybe actually even 1997. I think actually it was early 1998 when the inclusionary zoning ordinance was first adopted. Basically what they said was, for buildings, housing with 10 or more units, for every, once you break 10, then you are required to give the city one, and for that you get one back. So you can build one more market. Back then the percentage was 15%, but it effectively became less when you sort of increased the denominator because you were able to get.
That was always a frustrating fight at the time, because it was just like a simple math problem. You're like, yes, when you take them all into consideration, the ratio goes down slightly, but it's not. I think it was made to appear as if there was something invidious going on, and it just wasn't the case.
But the analysis at the time basically led to the conclusion that in order to, together with giving a density bonus for affordable housing, for inclusionary projects, that you had to give a one-for-one match,
right,
in order to have it not be just sort of like stealing the property owner's money, right?
It's called a taking.
Yes, a taking. So they actually worried about things like that back then. Whereas when they did the amendments, about 4 or 5 years ago now, it seemed like all of that was sort of like a thing of the past, because after all, don't you know, every project is going to make so profitable that this is just nothing. And they just upped the inclusionary percentage from 15% to 20%,
right,
and it was a flat 20%. There was no more giving it, getting an extra unit for every unit anymore.
So what happened was another political moment in 2015 where everyone was saying that housing developers were getting away with murder, because they were building all this housing and only giving 10% to 11% to affordable. That's the reduced number after you aggregate total units. That going to 20% was, and actually people were advocating for a lot more than that at the time. They were advocating for 25%. Some groups wanted to be 33%. without really any sort of mathematical justification for doing so. But as you pointed out, the trade-off back then was a one-to-one in terms of unit count. Now they take the square footage, and they did not increase the bonus. And I would argue now that you could probably bring an argument that it is a taking, that you're required to build out this 20%, give it to the city, and then you get a density bonus. And in a lot of cases, you can't use the density bonus because of other regulations that pop up vis-a-vis height limitations, setback limitations, that you may have to get a variance for that you would not be, really allowed to get. It was interesting to hear Councillor Azeem chime in, because of all the inclusionary ordinances out there, Boston has one, Cambridge has one, and Somerville has one. Somerville is actually the more egregious, more restrictive, and they've went down to 4 units. And what they've found is almost a complete falling off a cliff in terms of affordable housing development. No one's doing it because it's simply just too costly. And it was nice to hear at least one counselor point out that Cambridge too at 20% has yet to really show that it works.
I think we've talked about this before, but when the governor and then with the vote of the legislature passed, I believe it's called the Housing Choice Act. It actually explicitly puts a clause in there, because it's trying to produce, basically lead to some generation of housing, affordable or not, just more housing, right? Yeah. And they actually have a clause in there, which basically is like a warning.
Yes.
That you could have inclusionary zoning provisions with all the best intentions leading to a drop off in housing production so much so that it was actually completely counterproductive.
So the way it reads right now, it seems you have to provide documented proof if you want to go to 20% that is actually not going to discourage housing development. Boston and Cambridge and Somerville were grandfathered in. Boston is toying with the notion of doing this, but they live in a different category because in relation to zoning. They have the ability to have a little bit more leeway there, but most municipalities that are subject to Chapter 48 would not be able to immediately jump to 20%. Go ahead.
There's one other aspect of this, which again, I'm not going to claim expertise in, but it just seemed to me that if you build a project and you're basically have essentially like a city has a lien on it, a permanent lien on it for 20% of the units, then again, I guess maybe the sky's the limits for rent and such these days anyway, but it would seem to me that in order to cover the costs for the inclusionary units, it almost requires you to jack up rents. Yeah. Now they may be wanting to do that anyway, right? Who knows? But it certainly it makes it more inevitable that the rents for the market units have to be considerably higher.
You kind of lean into an interesting topic as well, because we're all talking about rent control again. And I was talking to a nice group of HBS professors yesterday about this exact issue. And you're talking about costs. That's what this committee was really about. When you have the upfront cost of having to give the city 20% of your building, that you have to build for them and give to them at a massively discounted rate. And in terms of a pro forma, most of the guys put it, 0-10% of what market should be at most. And then if you're capping rates on the back end, we never lived in a universe where inclusionary zoning and rent control exist. So it's going to be interesting to me. And I told these guys, I don't know the answer, but it'd be interesting to see how that affects everything. But we also, we talked about inclusionary zoning. We talked about linkage. Cambridge has the highest linkage by a factor of 2 to 3x, depending on where you go right now. I can't even compare Watertown because they're like $4 and we're $33.34 a foot. Interestingly enough, Boston has a linkage program where they've broken out linkage by use. They charge labs at a much higher rate than they charge everything else. Something that I suggested we do. And you can see right now, they have, their proposal is to go after lab at $25 a foot. But we discovered in Cambridge that The Nexus study that we use to sort of justify legally linkage tethers the linkage rate to the use that has the more disproportionate effect on affordable housing. And now that seems kind of confusing to me, but the way that they do that math is, you know, essentially someone who works in a restaurant, someone who works in a retail space has a lower income and therefore will more likely need housing, therefore or housing subsidy, and therefore those uses are taxed at a higher rate than we would a lab, which has people making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and they can, you know, they can find their own housing, they're fine. Which to my, you know, it's a way to look, it's a way to look at it, but my argument is the exact wrong way to look at it. And that if we wanted to actually get some normalcy in our linkage payments, you can keep the lab fee at $33.34, but I would cut it in half or more for everything else. You just simply cannot justify that cost for a hotel. You can't justify that cost for big box commercial and office space, my friends. Let us hold a glass and sing an obituary to them. They're done for a long time. You know, the Boston, you know, Boston, Cambridge, Boston's at 17% vacancy right now. Cambridge is headed to about 25% by the end of this year.
And that's for office space?
Yeah, that's a big
deal. Is that new or just across the board for all?
I'll cross the board for all.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that high. But I mean, I knew there was going to be an impact, especially with the COVID and then let's call it post-COVID reality, which is that a lot of companies realize that, in fact, they could get away with not necessarily occupying nearly as much floor space in buildings.
It's a big overhead cost, especially in places like Kendall, where you'll see the majority of these things happen. But it's... The problem is you can't really retrofit those buildings into housing. You can't wave a magic wand to do that. There's a whole economic structure to all these things too that makes it just unbearable. And a lot of us are just kind of sitting in our lawn chairs, eating popcorn, waiting to see what the banks do. It's really a big mess. And that was sort of an overarching theme for this conversation too, to say, there was a fella who was there sitting next to me who had done the Nexus studies for linkage. And while I wanted to tweak him on the ear, I didn't. But he was actually quite knowledgeable and quite articulate in his testimony in saying that the Nexus studies that we provide the council are really like a moment in time. So they're reflective of this, of an economic sort of pinpoint on a chronological scale. And we, you know, things change and we need to look at that. Most notably when we had the linkage increase, which was probably proposed by Zondervan to go to $33 based on a Nexus study from 2019. And I raised the issue, but I don't think people were really interested in hearing it. That, you know, just like with inclusionary, you know, when they jumped it to 20%, they based it on a 6-page study that said land costs cost $50,000 per unit. And that so long as rates are 4% or lower, you should be good. Well, none of that exists anymore. And it's the same for linkage too.
One of the things that it often occurs to me is that, you know, it's when you put things in a political sphere, when all these decisions of necessity, I think, have to be made by elected officials who are, you know, concerned about their popular appeal, or maybe I should say populist appeal. Yeah. There is a kind of like a Robin Hood type of mentality that takes over where, you know, they figure I'm going to do this for the people. And don't you know, we're going to build housing or whatever, and we're going to do linkage. And the thing is that the downstream effects of all of the heroic or at least apparent heroics that they're engaging in are actually can work in the opposite fashion of what they seem to be endorsing.
To my mind, it's a bit of a circular conversation between the council and the CDD and their consultants that they hire. A lot of the times, just like this report, which I pointed out, you know, if you look at the conclusions at the end, it kind of just has this fluffy, like, it's really working, it's great, you know, we'll wait and see what happens. And I'm like, you know, I need an adult in the room that says, listen, you know, we have... each one of these categories of climate resiliency, BUTO, green roof, you know, carbon emissions, net zero, stretch code, you know, the climate resiliency regulations, they all have good goals. We all believe in those goals, but inclusionary, I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, look, you can go through it all.
Yeah, like, no, I mean, when you actually look at the sum total of all of these various initiatives, all of which can be argued are nice ideas.
Yeah.
But when you actually add up the cumulative effect of all the requirements, what does it actually translate into in terms of actual construction and outcomes?
I've noticed, and maybe you have too, that when you go to the city hall and you hear people talk, that you're either a housing guy or you're an environmental guy. Maybe you're a bike guy or girl or whatever. You know, I'm not trying to pigeonhole people, but I think there's not many people who say, okay, we need to look at it all. Because it's a balancing test amongst all these interests. And a lot of what we're doing right now, it weights the costs considerably on smaller to mid-sized development. Well, last I looked, and I've been, you know, been around now for a bit, no one's ever said we really want to build a bunch of high-rises and we'd only like for Alexandria and Boston Properties to run the show. I've never heard anyone say that. But the regulations that we put in place have made it pretty damn clear that that's what we want, because that's going to be the result. So, you know, I brought up simple things like in the green building code, there's a requirement to bring all of my net zero narratives and energy calculations, and about, you know, $250,000 to $300,000 expense to CDD in an application prior to a special permit. And I said, why would I spend $300,000 on a wish? You know, a special permit to my mind is a wish. And I'll be happy to do whatever needs to be done. But unless I have a project, you're asking small developers to spend hundreds of thousands, in some cases, millions of dollars to propose building a building before you even talk to a person about it. And then there's the building, and we talked a little bit about the building permit costs. It's like 20 per thousand right now. I gave them an example of the Middle East project, which is like 50,000 square feet. The conclusion is fun. You have the version with my notes on it?
No, I do not. Well, I think you sent me the link to it, but yeah, I don't know.
I did. It has all these little, but the the point is like, if I have to spend like $2 million, if anyone has to spend $750,000 just for a building permit, when linkage was going to go up to $33.34, the Middle East project would have had to pay somewhere around $2.5 million. The answer is not pay up. The answer is we're not doing it. Screw it. I'm not going to build a music venue and give a 50-year lease or an entitlement for that long. Or I can't. And it's really, I can't do any of it. None of it works. So like, you need to kind of pick what you want and where you want it. And I think, to my mind, you know, labs seem to be able to carry the ball a little bit further. And I don't know, every time I'm at a meeting talking about Buto, talking about green roofs, talking about whatever, I'm kind of like there by myself. If these big guys really cared about it, maybe they'd show up. But since they don't show up, I don't care about them. You know, so like, to my mind, if we want infill development, we're gonna have to make it a little less rigorous. And I also, I talked about sort of the dichotomy between mom and dad, CDD and ISD. We need one building for those guys. And I don't want to, you know, they play a little bit of ping pong with developers. There's a review process after special permit that is a bit of a gamesmanship thing with ISD. You're supposed to get your permit within a month, but it gets shoveled out for months and months and months, in some cases even longer than that. But can you go back to the conclusion piece again? Because I think the thing that I wanted to point out was that they made this conclusion about inclusionary zoning. It just frustrated the heck out of me. And, you know, some requirements affect revenue rather than cost. Example, inclusionary. And I said, what? I still have to build that 20%. That is a cost. The density bonus you give me, that is not dollar for dollar. And not only am I giving you paying for these units to be built, I'm also going to be subsidizing them as they are managed. So, you know, let's just be honest. The last part, in the long run, higher development costs due to regulatory requirements may be offset by lower land costs. Really? Really? It's like, okay. I don't know, maybe.
Maybe. So you know, something you said about, you know, in talking about sort of the lab developers or the big guys versus the small guys, it kind of reminded me of something that was often said about during the age of when rent control was kind of ruled the land here in Cambridge, which was that if you were kind of a small scale property owner, rent control basically said, this is not worth it. I'm just moving. I'm selling out. Right. And it tended to be I'm not going to name all the names of some of the big rent control landlords, but one of the things that happened during that period was like a consolidation of properties.
Yeah.
A lot of properties were being bought off by, you know, a relatively small number of more big players because they could basically run it like a management company and they could have, you know, a lot of staff that worked multiple buildings, you know. So the net effect was to drive out the small guys who ultimately were, I think, the people maybe in principle you would have preferred to have in favor of the people who then owned hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of units of rent-controlled housing.
And I'm going to say something that's going to shake you guys to your socialist cores. I think it's better generally when more people own property. I don't think it's a good outcome when we consolidate, when we have, like, look at Kendall. Kendall's owned by like three groups.
Right. No, I agree with you completely. And I worry sometimes that the general housing policies of the city is basically trying to drive more and more properties into fewer and fewer hands. Yeah. And people may say, well, yeah, but if those fewer hands are the Cambridge Housing Authority and Just the Start and Homeowners Rehab and a few other nonprofit developers, that's a good thing. But I still think that we would be a lot better off if it was broadcast amongst many.
I think that's one of Central Square's strengths. We have
we're down to 10 seconds here, so we'll have to take a break, but we'll come back for those who are interested. So see you in a few minutes on Cambridge Inside Out.